forgot that I'd turned the microphone off. If you could come on in and have a seat, we're ready to get started this morning. This is a different floor to be pacing around for teaching. Normally I'm upstairs with a bunch of rowdy but good teenagers, so it's good to be down here and see some more mature minds and faces, right? I don't hear a lot of agreement, right? it's up to me, right? Yeah, there you go. If you're visiting, we're glad to have you with us. I think I see a couple of new faces that at least I don't recognize. Ken and Janice have been out this week. They are making their relatively normal tour to hit family in Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana. So they've been going in that little triangle of that little round of places. So they will be back later. I think tomorrow is when he's supposed to be back. So please pray for their safety as they travel. We miss them both when they're gone, but we're thankful that they have the opportunity to get to do that. If you would join me in a word of prayer as we get started this morning, we'll get on into our study. Father, we love you so much, and we praise you for being the God that you are, for being an only God, for being our God. Father, we are grateful that we have this time to gather together and to worship you, to sing songs, and to study your word. Father, as we talk about, as we break open your word and as we talk about the things within it, Father, please guide us in our thoughts. Please guide us in all that we do, that we can be attentive to what it says, that we are open to what it says, and we accept it for what it is. We thank you so much for the blessing of being able to be here. Father, be with those who are not able to be with us today, whether it be sickness or traveling. God, please bring them back to us as soon as possible so that we can enjoy their company and have their strength and their talents among us once again. Thank you for your Son, for his life and his death and his resurrection. And it's in his name we pray. Amen. We have been studying the book of Romans, started in on that study over this quarter. And I will tell you, I'll just give you a preview right now or a heads up that whatever I tell you today, you're going to hear again. not per se because Ken doesn't trust me to teach it, but rather he's as he's made mention, he said, Corey, I have waited for 40 years to be able to get this on DVD. This is the best shot I have. So he says, whatever you talk about today that has anything to do with Romans, I'm going to say it all over again just because. So we may touch on something a little bit new. I have a somewhat of an idea where he's at. If it's not something new, then bear with me and we'll use it as refresher. I want to begin by maybe giving you a little bit of an idea how this particular study has affected my life. Most of you are aware that I came here from Freed Hardeman University in West Tennessee. I grew up in Huntsville, Alabama. Grew up the family as part of a Christian family. My dad is currently an elder in the congregation where I grew up. He had served as a deacon there before. He went to Freed Hardeman and was a preacher for a portion of his life. My uncle was also preached for many years, and he is now an elder in Kentucky. My granddad is an elder in Kentucky, and I have various sundry other family members who are very active Christians. So I was very blessed to come from a Christian home. Went to Freed Hardeman with the intent of going into ministry. I can tell you the moment that I decided I was going to be a minister. I was in sixth grade. I kid you not. It's not an over-exaggeration. I was in sixth grade when I said, I'm going to be a preacher. And so that's kind of been a lifelong dream. Somewhere along the way, as I made that decision so early in my life, I began trying to figure out, okay, what is it that is the preacher supposed to do, right? You get lots of people who have their opinions of what the preacher's supposed to do, and you get lots of preachers who tell you what the preacher's supposed to do, and so you just kind of start pulling in all these bits and pieces, and you put them together. somewhere along the way, I developed an idea or a mentality that one of my jobs as a preacher in the church was to be everybody's policeman. It was my job to keep tabs on who was teaching what, on who was preaching this, who was practicing this, that, or the other, whether that was within my own, the congregation that I worked with, or whether that was in the entire city that where I may find myself working at. It may have even been within the entire region where I was at. You got to keep tabs on everybody, and you got to make sure that you don't let anybody pull the wool over someone else's eye, and if somebody else is doing something wrong, you got to call them out on it, even if you've never met them in your entire life. There's no chance you're ever going to meet them. That was my job. And as a result, I was pretty, I don't know if you want to call it hot-headed or whatever. I was pretty stern about some things. Case in point, when I got to Freed my freshman year, Tennessee's one of those places where you can go around every corner and there's a Church of Christ sitting on the street corner, right? you go within 50 miles, you'd probably find 50 congregations, right? It's what it feels like, at least. And so freshman year at a school like Freed, you're going all over the place. You're visiting one place or another, trying to figure out where you're going to go. You're going to go to the big congregation that's right across the street or right down the road, or are you going to go find a medium-sized one somewhere? You're going to go find a little bitty congregation that you can be a part of and you feel comfortable in. I didn't know, so I went to this place called Jack's Creek. And I walked through the door, and we were sitting there. It came time for the Lord's Supper. And now you need to maybe know this will help. Where I come from at West Huntsville, the request is made by the elders that if you're standing up helping to serve the Lord's Supper, they ask that everybody wear suit and tie, right? Fair request. There's an honor and a respect for what's taking place. I get it. I'm all for it. That's where I've come from. 18 years is what my life had been. Been to other places, small country congregations in Kentucky, where they didn't do suit and tie, but there was definitely a respectable air about it. I'm sitting there in the pew. This guy walks up to do the Lord's Supper. He's got long, shaggy hair pulled back in a ponytail, and he's got a beard that was reminiscent of Duck Commander beards, right? And he's got on a pair of ripped jean shorts, old dingy T-shirt, and he gets up and prepares to do the Lord's Supper. And I'm sitting here, sitting back going, who are you? Right? And that was rough enough. Even to this day, it's like, okay, I don't know anything about this guy's background. For all I know, that was the best set of clothing he had. I don't know. Even today, I would probably still, if I had a chance to talk to him, I'd say, hey, can we talk about this a little bit? You got a little bit better something hanging up in your closet? But what came next is what really got me hot. He reached in, and I'm used to seeing the trays. You pull the tray up, and you got the crackers about that big, right? He pulls it off. He pulls the little covering off, and there's this single loaf of bread about that big. And he took his round, and he took it, and he folded it in half, and he ripped it. He laid it over, and he ripped it, and he folded it and ripped it again. It's breaking bread. I had steam coming out my ears, people. Because in my mind, I'm sitting there going, that's not how you do the Lord's Supper. There's no way on earth that can be how you do the Lord's Supper. And I got hot. Oh, I was so hot. Clenching my teeth, steam coming out my ears, I feel my blood pressure going up. And remember, I'm 18 years old at this point in time, right? And when everything was all said and done, we left, and the girl I was dating at the time, we got out to the car, and I got in, slammed the door shut, and I was just going off on how ridiculous and how terrible that was. You don't do that in the Lord's Supper. Da, 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 da. And she said, Corey, whoa. Let me ask you a question. Are you mad because it was entirely 100% wrong, or are you mad because it was different? And for the first time in my life, agree with her or not, but for the first time in my life, that hit me between the eyes. And I had to say, okay, let me back this up a little bit. Again, I've made the statement that I don't particularly like the way that the guy was dressed or whatever. That's another story for another time, another discussion for another time. But from that point on, as I began to continue to go through my college courses and have internships and get hands-on in ministry and all this, that, and the other, there were things that I, as I would study passages, that I just knew that I knew what it meant. As I would study them more and more, there were conclusions that I had drawn. I'm not going to say, per se, somebody gave them to me. Conclusions I had drawn that all of a sudden they didn't quite fit with the context that I was reading. On some things. Not a lot, but a few things. Okay? And I wound up having a lot of different questions or things that I wrestled with. Let me point out. Never doubted my faith. Never doubted the gospel. Never doubted any of that. Okay? Never doubted my upbringing. Just little things as I'm trying to put all the pieces together. Something was missing. Okay? And then when I moved here, and Ken and I finally, he came about 2 or 3 years into my tenure here. When Ken and I came and we began to talk about this book, and I began to see things in the context that they're written in, all of a sudden there was just this little cog that had been sitting over here I hadn't quite seen yet. And it's like somebody picked it up and stuck it right there. And all of a sudden I had some gears that started turning that had never turned for me before. Now, I will not say in the least little bit that I have it all figured out. Please, you know me well enough. I'm never going to pretend that. But there were at least some things that had seemed a little off for me, conclusions I had drawn that didn't quite fit with what I was studying and reading anymore, that now all of a sudden they had a proper context. For me, that's what this study has done. And as a result, I can tell you now, it's helped to lighten my load a lot. I don't feel as compelled to be everyone else's policeman anymore. Doesn't mean I won't talk doctrines or practices or whatever. You want to have that conversation, let's sit and have it. And the Bible is the Bible, and the Word of God is the Word of God, and we're going to do what the Bible says, right? But there's a difference for me now in let's sit and talk about it and study about it and me be on a headhunt to try to find out who's right and who's wrong and me try to call you out on the carpet even if we've never met before. That's where I've come from. And kind of help give you an idea of where I'm at now. So I tell you that with the hopes that wherever you are, whatever process you're at in your walk with Christ, I tell everybody that I sit down to study with, if you will let the message of the Word, if you will let it, it will change your life forever. And I will tell you that as well. For some of you, this will be, this study is an affirmation. It's a reaffirming of what you've known. For others of you, maybe some of this is a little foreign. Or maybe you're like me in that you're on the cusp of it, you've seen it, but you haven't quite had the right cog to be able to put in place to make that machine work all the way around. You're going to be in this book a long time. Okay? Ken's going to, I think he said he's looking to do this in 6 months, and even then you're only going to cover half the book. Isn't that great? But that's, allow it. Listen to the message. Listen to what the Scriptures are saying. And it will change your life if you let it. From what I've understood, Ken has focused most of his time, gone through chapter 1, correct? Head nods will work here. Chapter 1, verses 18 through 32. Okay. You see in that a description. I like to call it man's downward spiral. Okay. He makes the affirmation on the front end that for the wrath of God is being revealed upon those who suppress the truth. What is that truth? This is where you can respond back. What is the truth that is being referenced in Romans 1:18? Do it. Is it the gospel? And what is the truth? He says in Romans 1, 18 and 19 that the wrath of God is being revealed upon heaven, being revealed from heaven upon those who suppress the truth. What was the truth in this text that's being suppressed? God's eternal power. The fact that God exists. Now, we say gospel and all that kind of stuff, and okay, yes, is that suppressed in our society? Sure it is. But in this particular text, make note, you need to look specifically at what he's actually saying here. Let me get it pulled up. He puts this in its context for us. This is Romans chapter 1, verse 18, for the wrath of God revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. What truth? For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and his divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. The truth that is being suppressed here is the fact that God exists. Okay? And the reason he says that is look around at nature. It's hard to go to the top of a mountain that a group of us did in Colorado earlier this summer. It's hard to go to the top of a mountain, stand up there freezing your ears off, and say, God, you're nothing. It's hard to have that thunderstorm that rolled through some parts of this yesterday and had thunder that shook my whole house and say, God, you're nothing. You ain't got nothing. Come on, is that the best you got? Or to even go so far as say, God, you're not there. Now, why is it not the gospel or some of these other things, or Old Covenant and all that? Can I go to the top of a mountain and look around at nature and say, Jesus is the Son of God and he came to this earth and he died on the cross to save me from my sins? Can I know that by looking at a mountaintop? No, I can't. That is something that has to actually be revealed to me, or anyone else for that matter. His evidence here is he says, look at nature. Whatever there is to know about God through nature, God's revealed it. What is it? His eternal power. His divine nature and his eternal power. God is there. And so from that point on, you see that downward spiral. How does mankind or a person, I tend to see this passage more in the scope of societies. How does a society get to the point where they say there is no God? Well, it's off by not being thankful. For even though, 21, for though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. Okay? They ceased to give thanks for God. They basically said, they looked around, society looks around at all the wealth and accomplishments and everything that's going on, and they say, hey, you know what? I did this. God hadn't done anything for me. Why should I offer thanks to him? Now, maybe we hear that in absolute specific statements, and maybe it's a mentality, probably more likely it's a mentality that creeps in, right? As we begin to amass more and more and more, there's that tendency to think, man, I have really, really worked hard the last 10, 15, 20, 30 years, and look at everything I've gotten as a result of it. And we cease to thank God. So what is the result? He says, instead, they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. 22, second step. First is we cease to be thankful. Second step in that downward spiral, claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Man became so smart, man became so intelligent, that he picked up a rock and a beetle crawled out from underneath. And he said, oh God, how are you? He became so wise, he became so intelligent that a calf was born one day. And they said, that is the incarnate of our God. Literally, this word fools, you've heard this. Okay, the word moros, M-O-R-O-S, we get the word morons. Claiming to be wise, they became morons because they took, man took his wisdom, elevated it up here, and had God and brought him down here. So you look at the steps, how this goes. God's up here to begin with. Mankind is down here. We cease to thank God. We say, God, I don't owe you anything. So now we've brought him to our level, right? You're no better than I am. You haven't done anything for me. Then we say, claiming to be wise, well, God, your knowledge is not as good as mine. So then we shift and we place mankind's knowledge above God's. As a result, we begin worshiping the creature instead of the Creator. And what is the result? What does God do when these things take place? Look at verse 24. Therefore, God gave them up to the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves. That phrase, God gave them up, scares me to death. Because as much as I want to see God as the one who's going to fight for me all the time, the Scriptures are showing me that there does come a time when I push and I push and I push, if I keep butting heads with God, He is eventually going to say, okay. And it's kind of like the parent who has the rebellious teenager, right? That you fight with him and fight with him and fight with him. And at some point, you get tired of fighting because you know that the more you push, the harder they push, and you can't do anything else with it. So what do you find yourself the only other option? Step aside. Let them go do what they are bent on doing. Does that mean you don't love them anymore? No. But there's no other option left. You step aside, you let them go do what they want to do, and you make sure they understand, look, you know I don't approve of this, you know I don't like this, but I love you, and you're not going to listen to the rules of this house, but I want you to know you can always come home, right? When you're done with this, and you've figured out what a horrible road this is, you can always come home. That's what God does here. Mankind brings him down to equal level and then shifts his own knowledge above God's. God says, look, you're butting heads here, but okay, have at it. Therefore, God gave them up to the lust of their hearts, to impurity. This is immorality, right? Dishonoring their bodies amongst themselves, sexual immorality. And he goes on from there. Verse 25, that because they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator. And the further he goes, the further mankind goes, the next step in that downward spiral is not just immorality, but gross, what we might call gross immorality. For this reason, 26, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. And he proceeds to describe what that is. Women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature, and the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty of their error. Man kept pushing. God, I kind of like this freedom here. Why don't you just step aside a little bit more? I don't want to have anything to do with you. I'm smarter than you, and you can't control me. So God says, okay. And these dishonorable passions are homosexual activity. Just cut to the chase. That's what it is. And you can look all throughout history and you can see how nations, societies follow this pattern. We stop thanking God. We exalt ourselves above Him. Therefore, immorality sets in, and the longer that stays in place, ultimately you have this gross immorality, this addition of homosexual activity. And when you've come to that point, what is the only other step? What's the only other logical place that you can go from there as far as with regards to your relationship to God? When you have come to the point that you're either practicing or accepting of homosexuality, the only next logical step, verse 28, and since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, they said, there is no God. Why then? Why does a person or a society, let's go society, why does a society that has reached this incredibly low level of immorality, why is it that they have to say there is no God if they're going to accept and practice homosexuality and other forms of immorality? They know it's wrong. deep in their hearts, they know it's wrong. And if I have to say there is no God, because if there is a God, then everything I'm doing right now is wrong. What does God do at that point? When a society or a person gets to the point of saying there is no God, even God's not through with letting you step a bit further. God gave them over to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. And then from 29 through 31, you get this long list of different things that characterize a debased mind. Not a comprehensive list, but it gives you a good enough concept. You can see what that lifestyle is like, right? Here's the kicker on it to me. When you get down to 32, though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but what? They give a hearty approval of them. Folks, you can't look at immorality and say, well, you know what? I wouldn't do it, but whatever floats your boat, that's fine by me. You can't do that. God puts that in the same category as you having taken part in it. There was a movie that came out several years ago. I never watched the whole movie. I only watched the first few minutes until I figured out what it was about. Denzel Washington, I think the name of the movie was Philadelphia. Anybody ever seen that before? If I'm remembering it correctly, here's the deal. Philadelphia is the story about a lawyer who was a homosexual. He came down, he contracted AIDS and was being fired by his firm because of it. They weren't saying it was because of it. That's what he was claiming. So he searches citywide to find a lawyer who will take his case. Denzel Washington steps forward and says, okay, fine, I'll take your case. Thought it was a worthy cause. And when all of this comes to light, Denzel steps in. They have their first day in the courtroom or whatever. And as he's leaving, he's going to the store. Okay? He's going to the corner store. Go get him a Coke. And as he's walking through the door, he has all these cameras and flashes and microphones being shoved in his face. And people going, hey, why did you take this fight? What do you think is so great about this cause? When did you realize you were gay? And he stops. He says, excuse me? They said, when did you realize that you're homosexual? He said, well, I'm not. I don't practice that. I don't believe in that. So, well, then why did you take his case if that's not who you are? You can't condemn something once you've laughed at it. You can't call somebody out on the carpet once you've shown that you approve of what they do. That's biblical, folks. Knowing God's decree that those who practice these things are worthy of death, they not only do them, but they give a hearty approval of them. Thus, the end result is that this is the downward spiral. God's wrath is going to be revealed from heaven upon those who do not, who suppress the truth that God exists. Let me tease you a little bit for the rest of the time that we have with what's coming down the pipe. We're gonna kind of sniff into chapter 2 for a few minutes. Again, I told you, you're going to hear it all over again because Ken's going to keep going, okay, regardless of what I do. Suppose then, if we're looking at this idea that somebody says God doesn't exist and this is how he went down, he started off knowing God, okay? He knows about God. He knows God is there. He knows that God is ultimate and the creator. And yet somehow he comes up to the point of saying there is no God. When you get to chapter 2, chapter 1 is that macro view, right? He's way out here. Come into chapter 2, he zooms that in real tight. And he starts looking at individuals. How is God going to deal with individuals? And the idea of whether or not they are saved or lost and all this kind of stuff. And we start asking these questions. What's God going to do with that guy out there in the jungle who's never heard about God? He's never seen a Bible. He's never heard about Jesus. He may acknowledge that there is a God. Hey, societies all across the world acknowledge that there is a greater power, right? But you look a little closer, but it's not Yahweh God that they're worshiping, right? What is God going to do with that guy or that girl that stands before him and they've never seen a Bible before? Now, I don't know about you, but I'm sure maybe a lot of us have painted a picture that on Judgment Day, when we're all standing before the throne, that God's going to step up to that throne or the podium or whatever layout God has of the room, and he's going to open up the Bible, and he's going to start saying, well, Corey, you did this, you didn't do this, and he's going to compare my life to the Bible and make a determination whether or not I'm allowed into heaven or not. That's fine and dandy for a guy like me, because I've had the Bible in my hand since I came out. I had one of those little King James, you know, right? Pat, pat, pat the Bible. We've all seen our kids do that. I've had one of those or some copy of the Scriptures in my disposal since I came out of the womb, as perhaps many, if not most of us here have. But when that guy steps forward and God opens up the Bible and that guy looks, he says, hey, what are you reading from? I've never seen that before. God says, well, you didn't do this, you didn't do this, you didn't do this, you didn't do this. He says, wait, Lord, I don't know what you're reading. I've never heard this before. Is God going to hold that guy who's never seen a Bible? Is he going to hold him responsible for the Bible itself? Now, God is God. I'm not. God is righteous. I'm not. He can do it the way he wants to do it. But there is just that part of me that I look at that scenario and I think that's especially unfair, right? So what is God going to do? Well, we have three options, okay? Three options to answer that question. We can either say, number one, as lots and lots of people like to say, well, God is a God of love. And he's going to take care of that guy. That guy's lived in ignorance of the Scriptures, and he lived in ignorance of Jesus all of his life. And so God's going to take care of him, and when he stands for him, God's going to let him in because he was ignorant about the Scriptures his whole life. That's one answer. Second answer would be to say, I don't know. Not my problem. Which many of us take a look at this particular question and we say, I don't know, there's no way I can know, so I'm not even going to bother with it. The third answer is to say, well, he's going to be lost when he stands before God. Now, that kind-hearted side of us says, that's kind of cruel, right? We don't like that answer, but it is an option nonetheless. Consider then the pros and cons of each of those answers. Let's start with the second one, to say, I don't know. Is it legitimate or effective for us to just say, I don't know what God's going to do with that guy, so I'm not even going to bother looking into it? No, I'm going to say no. It's not a legitimate answer because the Scriptures deal with it. Chapter 2, which is where you're headed, depending on how much we get through today. Jeremy, were you raising your hand or were you giving... Okay. Yeah. So I can't look at that question, what's God going to do with the one who's never heard about the Bible or never heard about God? What's he going to do with him? I can't say I don't know. I can, but that's not a complete answer. Let's look at the first response, the first possible one that we said, to answer that God is a God of love and he's going to let that guy into heaven because he was ignorant about God his whole life. Now, doesn't that sound really loving and caring and wonderful on the surface? You can nod your head this way. Sure it does. We kind of like the sound of that. But there's a problem. There's a problem with that answer. If this guy gets to heaven because he never heard about the Bible, what happens if I take him the gospel? he automatically had the chance, a greater chance of being lost. So you have a conflict here. God told us, go to all the world and make disciples of every nation, right? Carry the gospel with you wherever you go and teach it to everyone that you see. That's my commission as a Christian. And if I go out to this guy who's never heard of the gospel before, and he's okay with God, God says, hey, he's fine. Just don't say anything to him. He's going to get to heaven based on his ignorance. And then I take him the gospel. He looks at the message, and he says, no thanks. And he turns around and walks away. Is he going to be condemned? Sure he is. Whose fault is it, at least in part, on that point? It's partly my fault. Because I changed his scenario for him by bringing him the scriptures. So there is a logical problem with the answer, well, God's a God of love, and he's going to take it. He's going to take care of that guy. Because that answer negates the Great Commission on my part. What's that third option, then? It's the one we don't like. It's the one we don't like. That when that guy stands before God on Judgment Day, even though he's never seen a Bible, even though he's never, maybe he's never heard about God, he's still going to be lost. And in doing so, let me get this point, and I'll get your comment. And in doing, in making that realization, that adds an extra level of importance for us as Christians to go do what? To go teach the gospel, to go spread this word throughout all the world, because without it, there is no lifeboat. Yes, sir. Fabulous point. And that actually transitions us to our next part about this. If you couldn't hear him, what George said is, you know, we need to make sure we remember the fact a person is not lost because they haven't heard about Jesus. Right? A person is not lost because they didn't go to church. A person is not lost because they weren't baptized. A person is lost because they sinned. Note the difference. The gospel doesn't have anything to do with why a person is lost. It has all to do with how a person is saved. But it has nothing to do with why a person is lost. Illustrate it one step further. And hopefully you've heard this question in here at this point. If Jesus had never come to this earth, would mankind be saved or would he be lost? To be lost. The gospel only exists because Jesus set foot on this earth. Right? If he'd never set foot on this earth, you wouldn't have a gospel and you'd still be lost. So then, what this brings us to, George's comment and reminder brings us to, is what then is God going to use to measure this guy who's never seen the scriptures before? Is he going to use the Bible? Or is there something else? What I will propose to you this morning, and as you're going to get a deeper discussion of later on down the road, a person who stands before God outside of Christ, please listen to that indicator, outside of Christ, a person who stands before God outside of Christ, God is going to use whatever standard you chose to live by. He's going to measure you according to that standard with the end result that no one is going to be found righteous. That's what chapter 2 of Romans describes for us. When we use, if we are outside of Christ, using, God's going to use whatever standard we chose to live by. He's going to judge us by that standard, and we're not even going to be able to measure up to our own standard. first. Now, let me just show you how that plays out with one, okay? One example, and then we'll be done. We quarter after, right, is when we usually wrap up. Or do y'all wait till 20? Quarter? Okay, yeah, y'all are like everyone else. Get finished faster. Sorry, that was out loud, wasn't it? Chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. Therefore, you have no excuse, O man, every one of you who judges. For in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself, because you, the judge, practice the very same things. We know that the judgment of God rightly falls on those who practice such things. Do you suppose, O man, you who judge those who practice such things and yet do them yourself, do you suppose that you will escape the judgment of God? First principle of this judgment that you're going to find, as we get in later, but to illustrate it for you, for one, is self-condemnation or self-judgment. And he asks the question, he says, do you suppose, you who judge, that you're going to escape God's judgment? Because what do? You walk to somebody and you say, hey, you can't do that. And then later you turn around and do what? You do the very same thing you just told somebody else that they're not allowed to do. You drew a line in the sand and then crossed your own line. Question, is God, and we talked about this in the sermon and we've talked about it in other places, is God saying here that there was a problem in the fact that they pointed out a shortfall from somebody else? No, that's not the problem. Okay, the problem is not that they drew a line. Please understand that. The problem is that they drew the line and then crossed it themselves. And if I were to just use that one, if I were God, or if God were to just use that one principle with somebody standing before him outside of Christ, if he were to say, did you ever tell somebody not to do this and then turn around and went and did it yourself? If we're honest with ourselves, what's pretty much everybody on the face, what's everybody going to do? Yeah, God, I did. Thus, you see the first start, the first example of the principle where God is going to use whatever standard a man chooses to live by, and he's going to judge him by it with the result that no one is going to be found righteous. Now, listen, as we wrap up, let me make this observation. This is not a fun set of topics to talk about, okay? This whole first section, you've got the 1:18 through 3:20, 3:21 to the end of chapter 5, and then chapter 6 through chapter 8. You've got three sections here of the book of Romans that you're going to talk about. I will tell you right now, this first one is the hardest pill to swallow. It's not the fun one. I tell people, when I've taught it with the kids upstairs, or I sit down and talk to them, I will tell them, my job for you in this first three chapters, my job is to make you feel like scum of the earth. My job is to make you feel lower than the lowest low. Because if we don't understand how horrible of a condition we have before God, the gospel doesn't mean anything. That's where you're headed. And I appreciate your time and attention today. Y'all have a wonderful time. Wonderful day.